Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm from the Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Casillas, the defendant in this case. My number is 34384. I want to speak as briefly as possible I can about the standard of review to be applied in this case. And the reason I don't want to spend a ton of time on it is because, in my opinion, I went under either standard of review. The state here argues that this is just a regular, old, standard, harmless error. I'm arguing that this is constitutional harmless error, and that would be pursuant to the Pronovost cases as well as the Golob decision. While I realize this case is not identical to the Pronovost case, because in that case the court excluded the expert witness solely because of the late endorsement. In this case, he excluded the testimony of the expert witness also because of the lateness of the endorsement, but he also did it because the expert wasn't available to testify in present.
Where is it in the record that indicates that because you're late, I won't allow the video conferencing testimony, as opposed to, as I read the record, I thought it said, I will allow the expert, I just won't allow the video conferencing testimony?
Well, in the first hearing on this, the prosecution objected primarily because of the late endorsement.
But the prosecution objected. Yeah. What did the court rule?
The defense conceded that, yes, we had indeed filed it late. And then the defense asked the court specifically to separate out these two issues of whether the court would exclude the testimony because of the timeline or whether we could, because of the late filing, or whether we could go ahead. The court specifically refused to separate out those two issues, and that cited on page 13 to 20 in the record, and it's, I just have it here as CD. I think the record was a little confusing. After the court said, I'm not going to separate out those two issues, where we actually asked the court to rule whether the court would bar the testimony even in lieu of the late endorsement, the court then specifically found that there was a late endorsement by 8 days and then denied the testimony to take place over video conference.
But in allowing live testimony from the expert, isn't the court effectively saying, I'm not going to preclude him just because he's late, I'm just going to require that he appear in person just like every other expert in the case?
Well, the problem here is that it was definitely a sanction in that respect, because the court well knew, we informed the court repeatedly, this expert will not be here. If you require his physical presence, that is the functional equivalent of an exclusion. This witness cannot be here. We're sorry. We asked for a continuance.
And
denied that.
Hadn't you been told, though, two other continuances based on expert witness issues, and the court had forewarned you there would be no more continuances based on expert witness issues?
With this particular expert witness, the record reflects that we had some problems in gaining funding. This was a public defender case, and we had to apply to the state office to get funding. We had had difficulty in receiving funding, and that was primarily the reason that this expert was endorsed 8 days later than the 30-day requirement. I don't deny that the court did say, look, you've had some continuances, but this was so critically fundamental to our defense, the court should have, at the bare minimum, continued it for a week, or allow this video deposition, or allow this live streaming option that we put forward.
Mr. Huff, does the record indicate, and I only ask this because I didn't see it anywhere in the briefs, why your expert witness could not come to Colorado for the trial on the date it was scheduled?
I don't think any of the parties specifically got into that reason. From what I remember from reading the record was he simply had a scheduling conflict of some sort and was not able to appear during the week that the trial was set.
This expert was well known, or at least he had been working with the defense for months and months. So,
well, I think it was a matter of just gaining the funding to fly him down here from California, put him up in a hotel, and keep him on the payroll until his opportunity came up to testify. That's what I gathered from the record, because we said the reason we didn't endorse this guy earlier is because we weren't sure we were going to be able to secure the funding for him to actually come down to Colorado and testify.
Now, there was a second expert that relied on this expert, so didn't that information come in through your second expert?
It didn't, and that's one of the main points I want to get to is the harm in this case, because the state argued in part, well, look, even if this was error, it was clearly harmless because you had your expert witness. She testified XYZ. That was similar to what this other witness would have said, but that's simply not the case. The witness that actually did testify in the trial was kind of an overall shaken baby syndrome type of a witness. She was testifying very broadly about whether this could have been an accident versus an intentional thing. She was not a radiologist. She never looked at the CT scans. The other doctor, Dr. Barnes, is the one that looked at the CT scans, examined the bones in particular, and made a number of different conclusions. I actually sat down and looked at the record again and figured out what the doctor that actually testified said and what Barnes, the one that didn't get to testify, would have said, and it's vastly different. Would you allow me to elaborate on that?
It's your time.
Okay. The doctor that actually testified said that she noticed a rib fracture, but she couldn't conclude whether or not this was a development deformity or whether it was the consequence of some physical action. She also testified about some retinal hemorrhages observed on the child. She testified that the skull fracture, in her opinion, could have been older or healed. It didn't necessarily have to take place in that time frame when the child was allegedly struck. She also talked about general symptoms of head injuries and what the child would experience, as the child did in this case, lethargy, choking, difficulty eating. And she also, the final thing she noticed was that there were no spinal cord or neck injuries, which she testified she would presume to see if this were in fact a true shaken baby type case. Barnes' testimony, which did not come in, although they did collaborate together, he was a radiologist. She specifically said, you give me a CT scan and it's Greek. I can't read it. I can't interpret it to the jury. I'm not a radiologist. Barnes, on the other hand, was a radiologist.
Didn't she relay Barnes' interpretation?
She did. She relayed the points where they both collaborated, but Barnes had much more to say than she did, specifically regarding the details of the injuries and the specific medical terminology of the injuries that he observed on the CT scans. For example, he testified, or they made an offer of proof. He had been a pediatric radiologist for over 30 years. He was an assistant professor of radiology at Stanford. That in and of itself, of course, would have presumably lended credibility to his opinions had he been able to offer them. Fundamentally, he said, look, I looked at the CT scans and I found facial osteopenia, which is decreased bone density, perhaps a vitamin D deficiency. He found irregular suture margins, rib flaring, arm bone irregularities in the skull fracture, unlike Tease, who just testified that she thought it could have been an older injury. He actually got into the specifics in his report and said, I think that the skull fracture was likely due to some pre-existing conditions. He listed oxygen deficiency, clotting disorder, infectious, post-infectious condition, connective tissue and vascular disorder, and potential seizure conditions. Now, like I said, he did collaborate with Tease to an extent, but she wasn't allowed to say, look, Dr. Barnes told me X, Y, and Z. Of course, that would have been inadmissible hearsay. She did testify as to some of the things that they collaborated on, but when it came to the specifics of the injuries and the ability to read those CT scans and read the radiology reports, she was completely unable to do so.
So I'm also interested in your other issue that you raised on appeal in your brief, you know, the admission of the other acts evidence. Can you discuss that for a couple minutes?
Absolutely. It's clear to me, if you read the Attorney General's reply brief, that this was purely offered for propensity. I'll get the quote from the Attorney General's brief right here. They say it's relevant, admissible, probative, primarily because, let's see. Because the defendant abused helpless little girls. That's the quote from the Attorney General's brief. That, to me, is propensity. And it's clear to anyone who's dealt with numerous 404B arguments that this in no way adduced any sort of motive. There was no argument that these two instances were connected in any way. They happened many months apart under entirely different circumstances. The child that was supposedly subject of the 404B was barely injured. It was something like a slapping and a pushing into a car. I mean, this bears absolutely no resemblance.
Didn't the judge find that there was a relevance independent of the inference of bad character to prove knowledge and absence of mistake?
Well, we never argued that this was an absence of mistake, and we never argued that when he dealt with his other daughter, he accidentally or mistakenly shoved her into the car.
Well, no, I think the issue was whether or not in this case with JC,
right,
he knowingly caused the death, or with respect to the second charge, whether he knowingly or recklessly engaged in an act that amounted to child abuse and resulted in death.
Had these been more similar, then I think that that conclusion would be more valid. In this case, we have an older child. I think she might have been, I can't remember the exact age, maybe 3 or 4-ish, versus a 3-month-old infant. Entirely different scenarios, a precocious child that he's disciplining perhaps too harshly versus this other incident where he allegedly struck the child's head repeatedly against a table or a wall or something. If they were closer in time and context and circumstance, then perhaps this could show an absence of mistake. They were just too far removed from one another. And the only reason they were put forth by the prosecution was to show that the defendant had a propensity abusing helpless little girls, as the Attorney General put it. That's the only reason that was introduced. It had absolutely no bearing on the facts at issue. It was purely meant to show that my client abuses his daughters. He has a pattern of doing it. He did it before. He's doing it now. But there's absolutely no connection otherwise, no nexus, no logical relevance. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Will Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. The defendant spent a lot of time on the harm that the so-called preclusion of Dr. Barnes had on his case, but I'd like to start with that the court didn't preclude Dr. Barnes from testifying. The trial court denied his request to have video testimony. And I think it goes with, I mean, in most cases, this isn't even an issue. If you can't get an expert who can't show up for trial, you find another expert. And as Judge Fox's question demonstrated, this defendant and the defense knew about this expert well in advance of trial, and there's no explanation as to why he couldn't be there. We don't know if he was in a car accident and couldn't be there for trial, or he had his annual golfing outing with his buddies and it was inconvenient for him to be there. So I think it's an extreme request to go against the general rule of requiring in-person testimony, and defendant's justification is basically, I wanted it. That's it. He can't be here and I want video testimony.
I thought Mr. Huff was explaining to us the reason for Dr. Barnes' testimony, which was a little bit more than I wanted it. I mean, he explained that Dr. Tease was testifying about certain things, but Dr. Barnes was a radiologist who could testify about other things.
No,
isn't that more than just saying, I want it?
No, he just wanted the video testimony. He provided no justification for it. I agree, he definitely wanted him to testify, but the trial court denied the video conferencing And basically, the defendant has provided no explanation as to why it was justified. The federal cases we cite say it should only be allowed in compelling circumstances, and they rely on the federal civil rule. But there are no circumstances that the defendant has presented here, much less compelling circumstances.
Well, wouldn't you say that the seriousness of the charges are pretty compelling? I mean, this guy was facing life in prison, or, you know, being in prison for the rest of his life. Couldn't this have been cured by granting yet another continuance, even though the trial court said it was not inclined to do that?
Well, let me start with, yes, this is a serious case, and I think that warrants that if you have an expert, he needs to show up. And the trial court said that in this type of case, if you have an expert, he needs to show up. So I think that cuts our way, actually. And with regard to the continuance, it has an overlap that he's provided no explanation as to either why he didn't ask for a continuance before this. Presumably, if he knew about Dr. Barnes, he knew about him at least 2 months before trial. I think there's possibility he knew about him at least 7 months before trial. And the defendant, notably, he asked for video conference, or he asked for telephone testimony first. That was denied. He asked for video testimony. That was denied. And he didn't ask for a continuance till the morning of trial. I think he waited until the prejudice was greatest to every party, and he has no explanation. If Dr. Barnes wasn't available, he knew about that well in advance. And if he didn't know about it well in advance, he should have. If you get an expert, you need to secure them for trial.
Go ahead, Judge. No, you go ahead. My question to you is, counsel argued that it's clear from the record it was imposed as a sanction, that the judge would not separate out the lateness of the request from the remedy requested or the sanction. And what's your response to that? Was it a sanction? And if not, why not?
Well, I would say it's not a sanction because the court never said it was a sanction. And I agree with Mr. Huff's characterization that he said he didn't want to separate it. But he said, Judge Krockenberg said, if he shows up, I'll allow it. And to me, there's no, how should I say this? If he shows up is kind of redundant. If you allow an endorsement, it's assumed you're going to have the person there to testify. And if you look at defendant's motion to request video testimony and motion to reconsider, trial defense counsel thought that's what happened too. The motion says the trial court granted the endorsement but denied our request for telephone conferencing. He never said, oh, this is a discovery sanction. There was no discovery sanction anywhere here.
Mr. Kozlowski, how would the people have been prejudiced by live video conferencing?
Well, I mean, I think the federal cases make clear that in-person testimony is preferred because as the Thornton case says, the ceremony of trial in the presence of the fact finder may exert powerful force for truth telling.
Well, I understand that, but increasingly, we have court hearings and administrative hearings where people testify by telephone, let alone by live video conferencing.
Well, I think it is on the increase, but I think it's within the trial court's discretion to say this prejudices the people. I think one example is the people would have had to disclose what they were going to impeach Dr. Barnes with in advance. The defense said, we can make any documents that he's going to have in front of him available before. So basically, the prosecution, presumably, if they had some articles to impeach him with, they would have to disclose that in advance, and he knows what they're going to ask him about. And I think just the general fairness notion that all the other experts had to undergo cross-examination in person. And cross-examination, that's one of the hardest parts for the witness about cross-examination is you're sitting there up there on your own being maybe seriously questioned. And I think that gets to a related point of this has potential not for abuse, but say Dr. Barnes was just getting hammered by the prosecutor, and then he says, "What was that? Can you hear me now?" moment. Like, this is based on a cell phone connection, essentially. So I think the trial court was well within its discretion to say to the defendant, "You've given me no justification to show that this is necessary, particularly when you should have known about this guy well in advance."
I thought from reading the briefs that the trial court judge was as much concerned about using this procedure because he had never done it before, opposed to prejudice that the people might experience.
Oh, I think it was definitely both. He started out with saying, "I've never done this before, and I basically don't want to take this on a test drive in a first-degree murder trial." That all the other experts are testifying in person. You have no reason why you're late on here, and I'm just not going to allow it. As he said, you can't assume that I'm going to grant this request. And moving on, let's see, I have 6 minutes left. Moving on to the harm argument. Even assuming there was some problem with the trial court's decision here, nothing about Dr. Barnes' testimony, as is set forth in his report, differed in any meaningful way from Dr. T's. Once you get past the big words in Dr. T's, or in Dr. Barnes' report, he basically was going to say the skull fracture could not be differentiated between accidental and non-accidental. That was the main point Dr. T's made, was, "I looked at the pathologist's report, and she is wrong in saying that this is non-accidental." And then I agree that there was a lot of additional information in Dr. Barnes' report having to do with bone irregularities and predisposing conditions. But defendant has never set forth how that had anything to do with how this baby died. None. Basically, it was undisputed at trial that this baby died of a massive traumatic brain injury.
The defendant said occurred, like, or was injured 2 weeks earlier.
Yes, I agree. His theory was it was an accident.
Right.
But Dr. Barnes is going to testify about all this stuff, about supposedly the rib fracture and weakening bone disorders. I mean, I'm no doctor, but assuming that's all to be true, he hasn't shown how that had anything to do with why the baby died. The defendant just said that the skull fracture was due to pre-existing bone conditions. That is not what that report says. The report says the baby possibly suffered from a pre-existing condition.
So I'm interested in your view on the second issue as well.
I figured you might.
Yeah, okay. Here's your shot at the title.
I think the defendants throw out propensity a lot. That propensity evidence is barred, which it is. But
how about we throw out relevance and tell us what it's relevant for?
Okay. It's relevant for what the trial court found it was relevant for: absence of mistake and knowledge. That
knowledge of what?
That the
facts were practically certain to cause her death?
Yes.
How do the prior incidents show us anything, one way or the other, about whether or not on the subsequent occasion he was practically certain that his acts would cause her death?
Well, I think it goes more to whether his action in the first place was purposeful to start with. That he previously harmed his other young daughter close in time. It was 3 months beforehand. It was not some remote other act. The harm to his child was not an accident. It was purposeful, knowing conduct by the defendant. From that, the jury could infer that it was less likely that the injuries to the infant were a result of an accident in this case. It was more likely that he knowingly harmed her.
Even though the circumstances are so different between the prior incidents.
With respect, I don't see how the circumstances are that different. Basically,
let me ask you this. In the evidence that was admitted at trial, wasn't there in both of the prior circumstances an issue about an argument with an adult?
That's true.
Was there any circumstance indicating that he had been arguing with the child's mother as she left the house that morning?
No, but I think the similarity, and I think Rath sets this forth, that the similarity is less important when you're dealing with intent and things like mistake.
It's less important, but where do we draw the line to tell us what is actually informative of intent and absence of mistake?
Well, I think that assumes that the third factor's there's at least something there, and that's within the court's discretion. If you look at the court's order, this is not something where the court just rubber stamped everything that the prosecution said. He was somewhat conservative in what he allowed in, and he disallowed a lot that he didn't allow that the defendant was yelled at the other child. So I think that where you draw the line is what the trial court thinks is relevant.
Trial court thinks is relevant. Appellate court has no role to play in reviewing the relevancy?
No, I think you do, but there's no notion that the court somehow went very far afield here, in my opinion. I don't have anything else unless judges have any other questions. We ask you to confirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I really want to impart on the court the bigger picture here, and it's fundamental fairness. We had the prosecutor who was allowed to call 5 expert witnesses to say that my client intentionally or recklessly or what had you killed his own daughter. We, on the other hand, got 1 expert. We asked to complete that testimony with another expert. We asked for a continuance. That was denied. The easiest remedy possible. We asked for
the continuance the very day of trial.
I know, Your Honor, I can't speak to that. I don't know why the defense did that, but it was clear from the very beginning that Dr. Barnes was not going to be able to testify on a particular date. And at that time, we were like, well, let's make alternate arrangements. Help us, court. Help us formulate a way that we can present our case to the jury. This is first-degree murder. In a first-degree murder case, this is not shoplifting. You can't just play willy-nilly. If the defense has a fundamental expert that needs to testify that has some mitigating information, the court needs to bend over backwards within the rules to accommodate. And this court didn't do it at all. And like you said, one of his fundamental reasons was, I'm not a technical guru. I don't know if this will work. Well, we had our technical guru come in and said it would work. And if it wouldn't work, we'll deal with that down the road. The problem is we got 1 expert to their 5s, and everybody knows that these sorts of cases are a battle of the experts because there's no witnesses, nothing definitive. The science is not clear. It can be subject to many interpretations. All we wanted to do was fill in those blanks and complete the second half of our case. And we weren't allowed to do that. Now my client's in prison for the rest of his life. And 2 experts said that it very well could be an accident. It very well could have resulted from that 2 weeks before. The jury only heard 1 expert to the prosecution's 5, and that was the court's fault here for not accommodating us in any way to complete our defense. Thank you.
Counsel, this will stand submitted in opinion and wish in due course. I want to thank both counsel in this case as well for their excellent arguments. They'll be very helpful with us in resolving the case.